Well, good morning. Welcome to the October session of the Nebraska Court of Appeals. My name is Larry Welch. I'm from Plattsmouth, Nebraska, and I am pleased to be joined here on my right by Judge Frankie Moore of North Platte, and remotely today by Judge Rico Bishop from Lincoln. She's appearing on the screen there. Counsel, can you see her fine?
Yes, I
can. Okay. When I call your matter here in a second, we'd ask you to please come forward. Recognize that these are public proceedings, so if there's anything private or confidential about anything today, please be cognizant of that in your remarks to us. And let's just check here and make sure everything's working. Counsel, for the appellee, can you hear us okay?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Thank you. And Judge Bishop, can you hear
us? Yes, I can.
Okay. And counsel for the appellee, could you hear Judge Bishop?
Yes, I can.
Okay, perfect. The first matter is the matter of State versus Walker, case number 19-1026. Counsel, if you would please approach. And if you're comfortable, you can remove your mask during oral arguments. It's entirely up to you, okay?
Thank you, Judge. Okay. Your Honors, may it please the court, I am Lori Hetcher, and together with Megan Jeffrey, we represent Ms. Chantel Walker. The facts underlying Ms. Walker's conviction for theft by deception are not really at issue here. What is at issue, though, is how the state of Nebraska attempted to prove those facts, namely the admissibility of a series of exhibits. The state attempted to prove the amount of the theft using a series of payment records by the Department of Treasury. These records were inadmissible hearsay. The state concedes that these records were hearsay. They were out-of-court statements attempted to prove the amount the SSA paid to Ms. Walker. However, the state claims that these were qualified to be admitted under the business records exception. The state admitted these exhibits through a Melissa Deuceman, who was a Social Security Administration technical expert. Now, these records were payment records by the Department of Treasury. Ms. Deuceman was not able to testify to whether these payments were the payment records were made in the course of day-to-day business or at or near the time of the event. Ms. Deuceman testified that she had a basic understanding of how these records were made and kept. In her understanding, the SSA, through agency direction via a computer interface, told the Department of Treasury what to pay and to whom and to when. That was the extent of her knowledge. She had the understanding that the Treasury issued checks or direct deposits at the time the SSA told them to, but she had no knowledge of when the payment records that they were using in the trial were made.
Counsel, if I can just maybe fast forward a bit. So is your sufficiency of the argument, or sufficiency of the evidence argument, based upon the failure to prove value should those exhibits not have been admitted, or does it go beyond that?
It goes beyond that, Your Honor. Our contention at trial and now was that Ms. Walker never intended to deceive the SSA. The state admitted several exhibits, such as the 2015 redetermination summary and the 2015 verification form. I believe the verification form was exhibit 4, that one of the questions was, does Andreas Walker, the minor who was receiving the benefits, reside with you? And the 2015 re-verification form, Ms. Walker checked no. And in handwritten next to that, she wrote something along the lines of, I get my daughter on the weekends, I go to her, she comes to me. And she reiterated this at a later date as well, saying that she goes to her daughter on the weekends, she stays with family members. Now, there was no testimony at trial that contradicted that. There was no testimony at trial that Ms. Walker didn't initially have her daughter when the payments began. But Ms. Walker told the SSA that as of December 14, she only got her daughter on the weekends.
There's some inconsistencies. Would you agree, though, in that testimony about when she was actually living at the house, when she wasn't, when she had custody, when she didn't?
Correct, Judge. There were inconsistencies. One of those inconsistencies came from that 2015 redetermination summary. The problem with this summary is that the summary itself had inconsistencies, It was mailed to Ms. Walker at a Redmond Avenue address, but the redetermination summary itself listed her current address as something completely different.
Let me ask a broader question as it relates to that. Is there evidence in this record that would establish that? I mean, certainly in 2010, when she filled out the application, she represented she was the she had custody and that her disabled daughter was living with her, correct?
Correct.
And it's very clear that that application provides that if that changes, if that status changes, she's supposed to inform the government about that, correct?
Correct.
Is there anything in this record that establishes that if she doesn't, if she loses that status, either custody status or living status, that she would no longer obtain those benefits?
No, Judge. And in fact, that was one of the questions we asked Ms. Deussman. And Ms. Deussman stated that the SSA prefers that a custodial parent receives the funds on behalf of a minor child, but it's not limited to a custodial parent. In fact, she said as long as the funds were still being used to pay for the minor's needs, that was still a valid payee. And so even though Ms. Walker was no longer the custodial parent, she was still eligible to receive the funds on behalf of Andreas.
But isn't it true that she refused to respond to requests for information about how those funds were being used? Repeated requests.
Correct, Judge. There was some difficulties in communication between Ms. Walker and the SSA. Some of those communication issues were because Ms. Walker continued to move. She moved several times, that's reflected in the record. And additionally, the SSA employee, Ms. Deussman, was not the only one who attempted to contact her. When she attempted to contact Ms. Walker, it was later than the theft period. I believe the first time was in 2017, when Ms. Deussman herself was the one who tried to speak with Ms. Walker. But prior to that, it was other employees that we did not hear from at trial, so we didn't get the full story there.
So there's something in the record where she responds and says, this is what I spent it on. She just didn't provide them with any receipts or backup or anything that the government was asking to demonstrate that, in fact, she was spending them on behalf of her, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I believe it was the 2015 redetermination summary or a later statement where Ms. Walker wrote, I was keeping receipts and our bus pass. However, I lost them in a 2016 fire. Her house burnt on fire in 2016, and she lost most of those records. And that was her explanation for why she did not turn over those receipts to the SSA. And so I contend, Your Honor, that all of this evidence demonstrates that Ms. Walker did not have the intent to deceive the SSA. It may not have been the clearest method of informing the SSA where her daughter now lived, may not have been the most eloquent or even the best spelling or the best handwriting, but she tried. And even if the SSA can now say that wasn't good enough, we didn't have a clear enough description of where Andreas lived, Ms. Walker did not have the intent to deceive. She was trying. She tried to tell the truth. I believe it's in the record that Ms. Walker herself was receiving Social Security disability for her own disabilities. She was trying. And she was the payee for a number of years, and she thought she did enough. She was surprised when this issue came up.
Was there evidence in the record that the SSA requested a refund, and if so, she failed to provide it?
Not in this record, Your Honor. I'm not aware of that.
Would you agree the record is clear that from the applicable period that they're talking about here, which is what, October of 2015 to March of 2016, that she was not the custodial parent anymore? Is that's correct?
Your Honor, from her own statements, yes, it was clear that Ms. Andreas did not live with her at that time.
And, well, that's different, right? The issue of whether she has custody and whether she lives with her. So that's a separate question.
Yes.
So the first question is, she no longer had custody from that period. Is that true?
This record does not establish who had legal or physical custody of Andreas. There was no custody agreement entered into. We did not hear from the other father, the father who was the other parent of Andreas. So we, in the record, does not state who had legal and primary physical custody of Andreas for the applicable
period. I don't remember if it's the redetermination summary or the Ruse interview or whatever, but at some point she acknowledges that the father obtained custody 3 years ago, right?
Correct. So that, again, through her own statements, she says, my daughter now lives with her father and has lived with her father for the past 3 years.
Okay, and then the record also indicates that she did not live with her during the applicable period, correct?
Correct.
So isn't the problem here that in the Exhibit 5, which was the redetermination summary, she claimed her daughter was living with her during this relevant period, but then in the ruse interview, Exhibit 1, that she acknowledged that her daughter had been living with the daughter's father for the relevant period. So there's that conflict in what she provided in terms of information to the Social Security Administration.
That's correct, Judge. And the ruse interview, it's important to note, was conducted 2 years after the applicable theft period. In addition, the redetermination summary, I believe, was dated February 2016. So those statements, because they were 4 months into the theft period, could not serve as the basis to induce the SSA to pay the funds to her because they were so far into the theft period. And if the judges have no further questions at this time, I'd like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Councilman. Counsel for the appellee, are you ready?
Yes.
Please.
May it please the court, my name is Austin Ralph. I represent the state of Nebraska. Essentially, Walker argues on appeal, one, that the district court erred in several of its evidentiary rulings, and two, in that the evidence was insufficient, she alleges, to support the conviction. As I set forth in my brief, as I'll discuss here shortly in detail, we disagree on both counts, and so we ask this court to affirm the judgment below. Concerning this court's questions, I'll skip to the sufficiency analysis, and I think, based on my brief, I don't have too much more. Yes, there are certainly fact questions, but I think the elements of the statutes were met here when we're looking at it in a light most favorable to the state. So you needed, obviously, a person commits theft if he obtains property of another by deception, and a person deceives, and then the statute lays out the different ways that they can do that. Here, I think the false impression that was created essentially was the fact that in 2010, when she applied for the benefits on behalf of her daughter, she represented that she was a custodial parent. The benefits were granted under that understanding. And when that changed, essentially, she did not correct the information. She did not update the SSA.
So let me press you on that. Yeah, let me press you on that question. So is it the state's position here that her failure to tell the state that, or the government, that she had lost custody or living arrangements, that alone was sufficient to constitute theft by deception? Or did the state need to also prove that she wasn't spending that money on behalf of her daughter?
Well, so I think the testimony, I can't recall if it was Deuceman or Chatterton, the agent, testifying essentially that it might be okay if the benefits were spent appropriately. But I don't understand how that would work. The statute criminalizes the obtaining of the benefits through deception. There's no safe harbor or anything for if they're used to benefit the child or benefit the person. So I guess I don't see how the benefits being used on behalf of the daughter, if they were in fact used that way, would change the fact that she obtained the benefits illegally and by deception.
So would you agree with me that there's, in this record, there's nothing that says that if her status changes, if she loses custody or if she's no longer living with her, that a condition proceeding to receiving that money are those two conditions? In other words, if those conditions are no longer met, she's not going to receive that money? Or does it just result in additional questions as to whether you should continue to receive that money?
Well, the custodial, as I recall from the record, the fact that a custodial parent is applying for the benefits, essentially, they would always be the one that gets the benefits, but a non-custodial parent could theoretically also get the benefits if the situation warranted. But I think it's kind of a red herring, I guess, whether she could have gotten them properly by alleging she was a non-custodial parent and had an interest in the child's welfare when she didn't. What happened here was the benefits were granted with the understanding that she was the custodial parent. And so when that changed, she needed to update the SSA. So whether she could have still received benefits on behalf of her daughter if she had updated the SSA, I think is a question that we don't have to address. So I don't know if that answered your question necessarily, but factually, I guess, in short, factually, she obtained the benefits on the understanding that she was the custodial parent. So whether she could have done it a different way, I think is irrelevant to the question here.
Well, it wasn't irrelevant to the SSA, was it, when they asked her for information as to how the benefits were spent and asked for documentation? That would lead you to believe that they wouldn't have pursued this had she provided adequate responses.
Well, perhaps, and I don't know why the SSA did what it did. But in terms of what we're talking about here, the sufficiency of the conviction on under state law, I don't think that those questions change the elements of the statute. And the statute here just simply criminalizes obtaining the benefits through deception. And I think we had enough evidence here to show that, considering the standard of review.
So the deception is that she failed to notify once the daughter wasn't living there, regardless of custody. Once the daughter wasn't living with her, she needed to notify Social Security. That's the deception.
I think so. It talks about a person deceives, it being the statute, a person deceives if he intentionally fails to correct a false impression which the deceiver previously created or reinforced. I think that's where we fall, based on the evidence. And the record, I think, is clear from the 2010 application that she applied for benefits as a custodial parent. She was notified in that application and repeatedly thereafter that she needed to update if the residential status of the minor changed, and she didn't. And so she, I think, continued receiving benefits until the custodial situation was clarified with the father in April 2016.
So let's move while you still have time to the second question or the second argument here about laying foundation for exhibits 14 through 20. Do you take the position that the state properly laid foundation through a Social Security employee of a Treasury record?
Yes. I don't think it's an issue necessarily that they are from a different organization when she is using those records daily. I guess all the statute requires is a custodian of the records or other qualified witness. And we're talking about a low bar in terms of authentication. All we have to do is show that enough basically to say it is what we say it is. And she works with these records every day. I don't think it'd be any different from, if I were called to testify about something in a different hearing, I think I could authenticate a court record. I could say, yes, this is a justice file because I work with them every day, even though I am not part of the judicial branch.
Well, does the low bar as it relates to authentication, that's only the third step of the three-part step. That's steps one and two, I don't think that the court's ever said that's a low bar in establishing that it's an activity regularly conducted and that the record was created at or about the time, correct?
Sure. But I think based on the record, we had sufficient, the two elements that you're talking about. One, that the activity recorded is of a type that regularly occurs in the business's day-to-day activities. I think we had that because she testifies essentially that these payments are every payment of the SSA goes through the Treasury system. That he automatically made the depositor issue the check on the scheduled dates. She explained further that every payment, I already said that, from Social Security goes through that system. And I think the clear implication was that the records of each payment were made at or near the time of payment. And specifically, I'm referring to page 184 and 214 of the record. So I think we met that first prong. And then the second prong is that it must establish that the record was made as part of a regular business practice at or near the time of the event recorded. Again, I think her testimony is pretty clear that this is an electronic database, that these records are made at the time the payment is made. Now they, as I said in my brief, they never explicitly, laid that out, sentence by sentence. But that's the clear implication if you look at the record, page 184 and 214.
I mean, it seems to me that the state was really arguing that because Social Security obtains this record through the Treasury database on a regular basis, that somehow should qualify it. But that's a 5B exception available in civil cases, not criminal cases, right?
Yeah, 5B is not available. The last sentence of it makes it clear it's not available in criminal proceedings. But I still maintain that we met it under 5A, that her testimony essentially showed that this is a regular occurrence in the business's day-to-day activities. Every payment goes through this system. It's an electronic database. It forms these records, enters the data at the time the transaction is made. I think that's sufficient to meet both prongs one and two of the analysis required under 8035. Yes, there it could have been done better, perhaps. Yes, it certainly could have been clearer. But based on the record, I think we have enough to say these are records that are made every day. Every payment goes through this system, and the data is inputted at the time the payment is made. I think that's sufficient. Add in the authentication low bar. I think that's sufficient to make the business record exception apply here.
If we were to conclude that it wasn't sufficient, where would that leave us?
I think that would leave us probably with sufficient to maintain the conviction, but perhaps not the level of offense. There would be no value proven, I think. So I guess that would drop the conviction down to the lowest offense, that something of value had been taken, but the value itself was not established.
Before you go, I did notice that there's some there's some social security numbers and the like in the record here. Does the state have any issue with respect to how that should be handled at this point?
You know, I guess I don't really know.
I'll ask defense.
I'm sorry, what was that, Your Honor?
I'll ask appellant's counsel here in a second as well. Is there any objection?
Yeah, the things are in the record. I don't know what necessarily we can do about it. Maybe the trial court, as the trial court can, perhaps redact things or do things after the fact. I'm not entirely sure on that. As far as the other exhibits, unless this court has questions, I would submit it on the brief that we think those were admitted properly over objection. And we ask this court to affirm the judgment. Thank you,
counsel. How much time do we have remaining?
57 seconds.
Okay. Before you're finished, if you'd also like to address my question, I think that there's some information and that probably needs to be protected. If you have any thoughts in that regard,
would you like me to address that now?
Please.
Your Honor, if the court is able to redact the social security numbers, I think that might be the best way to go about this. Now, I don't know if those numbers are tied to a name. From my recollection of the numbers, it's just the number. So I don't know if there's a risk of it being tied to an individual. But as they are sensitive information, if you would be willing to redact that, we would appreciate it.
We'll take a look at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Mr. Ralph commented that the clear implication was that these records were made at or near the time of the event in the day-to-day business. But a clear implication isn't enough for the gatekeeping function of the court. We rely on these hearsay rules to make sure that the information provided to the trier of fact is true. We didn't have that information here. And if there's no further questions, Judge, I'd like to just submit.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
The matter is submitted. Thank you both today.
Yes, thank you, Your Honors. Appreciate it.